This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of August 7th, here are a few top stories. In the news, a new report raised concerns across the state. Here's the show's Mark Brody and Steve Goldstein.
New findings from a report by the ACLU of Arizona shows minority students here are punished more often than their white counterparts and are much more likely to be suspended from school. African-American students are 8 times more likely to be suspended from certain schools than white students. Latino students are 6 times more likely. And Native American students are 10 times more likely, according to the report. And here to talk with us more about this is Alessandra Soler, Executive Director of the ACLU of Arizona. Alessandra, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So what was the motivation for doing this study? Was there a sense that there was something problematic going on here?
Yeah, several years ago, we started getting calls from parents, from moms of kids with special needs and moms of students of color, and they were calling because their kids were being suspended and expelled for minor offenses. And so, things like it was either behavioral issues or, dress code violations, not having a belt or having, a hairstyle that wasn't approved by the school. And so we then started, looking into it and went to data that's publicly available. Really the only data that's publicly available through the Office of Civil Rights and the federal government, Department of Ed. And then that's how we got to where we are today. I mean, the data was just astonishing, and it really confirmed what we've been hearing from the parents all along, that the kids are being, African-American kids, Latino kids, Native American kids are being disproportionately targeted, and some of the worst offenders are the kind of well-known high-performing charter schools. And like that study that you, the numbers that you quoted, the African-American students, this is in charter high schools, are 8 times more likely than their white peers to receive out-of-school suspension. So the racial disparities were just very, very significant.
Did you also look at traditional district schools in addition to charter schools? And did you include private schools as well?
We did. We only looked at public schools. So we looked at charter schools and district schools. And yes, I mean, in some categories, the district schools, the numbers in the district schools were also very troubling, particularly the district schools in neighboring tribal communities. That's where we had Native American students who were up to 10 times more likely than their white peers to be suspended. And when it came to students with disabilities in elementary and middle schools, both district schools and charter schools, they were twice as likely to be suspended. And so, this is obviously a major, major, very disturbing problem that is impacting schools across the board. And, our goal with this campaign is to really try to keep it as many kids as possible in schools and try to end these disturbing exclusionary practices that are pushing kids out.
What have you heard from school district and school officials about this?
That's a great question. What I'm most proud of is that, we have spent the last, year doing the analysis. And then what we've done is just shared the information with the schools. We've gone to the schools themselves, some of the worst offenders, and said, we went to schools in diverse neighborhoods and said, hey, here's the data. There have been some schools, that have voluntarily joined the coalition and said, we recognize there's a problem. And, these are both charter schools and district schools. Obviously, not all schools are with us, but we have, as part of the launch yesterday, we got commitment from 8 different schools who are going to be working to develop model policies to kind of reduce their numbers. And so, and this is some big school districts, in terms of the charters, Phoenix Collegiate Academy, ASA, Vista College Prep, Academia del Pueblo, those are the charter schools that have voluntarily joined the coalition and are committing to address this issue. And some big districts are like Pendergrass, Phoenix Union, Vault. Those are the school districts that have joined the coalition. Now we recognize, not everyone, obviously some of the big players, Great Hearts which was also, they had very, very disturbing numbers. Legacy, Leona Group, some of these big, large charters have not voluntarily participated, but we're going to continue the conversations with them and to try to see if they're interested in addressing the issue.
Alessandro, very quickly before we let you go, did you find how did you find the numbers in schools where the student body was more diverse versus schools that were predominantly maybe one racial group or ethnic group over another?
Well, I mean, Mesa is a large system, very diverse system. They have very, very high numbers of suspensions and expulsions of students of color. And so, you know, that's the one example. And, you know, there was we had our launch yesterday. Over 200 people were there, and we had some school board members from Mesa and some Native American parents whose kids are in the Mesa School District. And so we're hoping, you know, to continue the conversation with them so that, you know, they can begin to address this.
Alessandro Soler is executive director of the ACLU of Arizona. Alessandro, thanks a lot.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And now let's start cooking. Once again, here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
Mark, you know, I think everybody loves pizza, even me who tries to keep his calories low.
I know you are like the healthiest eater on earth, but I do know that your love of bread does extend to pizza.
Oh, that's because I've got to go deep dish all the way. What do you, now, as an Easterner, original
thin
Easterner?
Got to be thin crust. You got the big, like the greasy, floppy New York slice or just the really thin New Haven, thin crust New Haven pizza. Those are the best.
And do you mix meat and veggies as toppings?
Sure, why not?
I sure do as well. Now, if you're a pizza lover in Phoenix, you probably already know about Chef Chris Bianco. He has a few restaurants in the area, and food critics have hailed his pizza as some of the best in the country. And he's finally put his years of experience in the kitchen into a cookbook. It's called Bianco, Pizza, Pasta, and Other Food I Like.
Let's do it. Well, welcome to our little kitchen.
When I stepped into his kitchen at Trotto, I thought, naturally, he'd whip up a recipe from his cookbook.
I don't know if it's in the book. I don't think so. I don't think it is. I mean,
what
it's
actually
really
happened is what you might call kitchen improv.
Well, the recipe, as most things in our restaurants, make themselves. We get really beautiful things that farmers bring us, and we try not to screw them up. We just got delivered these beautiful little shishito peppers. They're little peppers, and they're kind of crazy because you'll eat one, and they're kind of sweet. Others are slightly spicy. Get a hot pan, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. All we're going to do is we're going to smack this little... I mean that in a loving way, a little garlic clove. All we're trying to do is warm them. We're gonna warm them. This is a little bit of Malvern sea salt. Then I'm gonna put a pinch of it on. We're gonna put a few chunks of black pepper. You can take them as far as you want. And then when we plate it, it's going to be done in like mere seconds. We're just going to plate with some aioli. So this is kind of like a garlic mayonnaise, basically, that we make. Got it with the spoon. Really beautiful. It looks like just a cornucopia of Christmas in the middle of a hot desert summer. We can have this plate of shishitos keep us company.
As we talked over the plate of peppers, it became clear that Bianco is just not a by-the-book kind of guy. He very much goes with what feels right at the time. And in the process of writing this cookbook, he says he wondered whether he'd even do it, because he worries cookbooks can make people think there's only one right way, and that can scare some people away from cooking.
This book was really one to say, how do you start the conversation? And I really think it will disappoint some people that know me that really believe that I was going to give them this cliff notes of this thing that they can make this perfect thing when on my children's life, the secret is there's no secret. You know, there's a meatball recipe from my mom that people ask me about my whole life. It is eerily similar to many, many meatball recipes out there. They're not that different. But in the assembly of it or in the execution of it, I think what's really cool about it or the opportunity is that my house will smell like your house. It smelled like my grandmother's house and maybe her grandmother's house. So it's really linked us into some type of unconscious aromatherapy in a way.
Is there a special kind of love or touch, though, that the average person can or cannot get from a standard cookbook? And is that why even you're talking about observations, is that sort of an important element to it where it's, this is what I'm thinking about this. It isn't just a list of ingredients or whatever.
Some of these are less recipes and more just observations. You know, I hope that we make you turn the the box around, the cereal box, or, you know, at the table, because that's what I did as a kid. I want to know it was in my post-ODs or whatever. And I was fascinated by small print and transparency.
In the book, and when you hear Chef Bianco speak, you might find more attention given to the ingredients themselves than the end result sometimes. He describes fresh mozzarella as a, quote, harnessed glass of milk, and talks about how the bread of a sandwich should be a, quote, cradle for the ingredients. And his passion for every part of food led to years of 18-hour days in the kitchen. In recent years, Bianco says he's taken a little step back and focused more attention on passing along his knowledge to others.
If you believe you can play your game with the same position your whole life, I believe we might be kidding ourselves. When we're younger, we think it's about, you know, pushing or pulling something, using our physicality to find our point of relevance. And I think the older I got, like, you know, people always saw me in front of the oven, you know, every day. And, you know, it was a 17-year period. I think I missed 4 shifts because I was sick. And what I realized is, first of all, it's a horrible recipe for your own life. You know, I mean, all this balance that I searched for in when I made you dinner, that I didn't have that in my life. And I still get in the oven, kitchen, I love to cook, but I can't do it 18 hours a day like I used to. And it is a younger person's game at that part. And thankfully for me, I have strong backs and arms and eyes that can see tickets clearly without squinting, and are at the point of execution that becomes a pivotal part of a restaurant business.
Okay, so this is a two-parter. One, why is pizza so unbelievably popular? And do you ever feel, even with the masterful nature of your pizza, do you ever feel like just picking up just a big old greasy slice?
I mean, yes, I do. I was just in New York, and people were asking about, oh, the best pizza in New York, what is it? And it might be a fuzzy Bobby Darin from a less than perfect jukebox, a slice that maybe is humble but good on a piece of wax paper, that the temperature of it is just hot enough that you know it's somebody looked after for you, but not hot, it's going to burn your hand. On the pizza side, I think what makes it so popular is in many places, especially in New York where I grew up, it was our first food we ate away from home. You know, maybe it was after Little League or Boy Scouts or Brownies. You know, I can remember my grandfather was a New York City fireman. When we go up there in the summer, I usually spend 2 weeks, and I remember that he wasn't the biggest conversationalist, especially with an 11, 12-year-old, but going down to get a pizza, a cheese pizza with sausage, and have it sit on my knees in the station wagon during the 11-minute drive home, we had a common denominator.
Well, Chris Bianco, thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Chef Chris Bianco. His cookbook is out now. We've got a recipe for you. This one, actually from the book. It's on our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. The opioid crisis is gripping the country. And here in Arizona, overdoses are killing at least 2 people a day. Governor Doug Ducey recently declared a public health emergency. This week, we began an ongoing series into what the state and others are doing about the problem. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Steve still has trouble making sense of his slide into addiction, how the occasional pill turned into 5-10 a day.
The fact that it did is still kind of blindsiding, just because I drank seldom as a teenager, but never really did anything else.
It began toward the end of college, down in Tucson, for the now 26-year-old. We're not using his real name. His partner had a spinal condition and would share his painkillers. When they ran out, they'd look elsewhere.
We were going through a lot. Just trying to sustain that was very tough.
That lasted for years, Steve says, losing friends, lying to each other.
We didn't have anything. We had taken out title loans on our cars. We had no credit, no money.
Steve's story has become all too familiar as the opioid crisis has turned into one of the most pressing public health threats.
It's a problem that knows no bounds. It affects men and women, young and old, rich and poor.
That's Arizona Governor Doug Ducey during his most recent State of the State address. The true extent of Arizona's crisis became painfully clear months later when the state released new numbers showing nearly 800 people died from overdoses in 2016, almost twice the number as in 2012. In response, the governor declared a public health emergency, a strategy that begins with actually tracking who's dying and where and how.
our opioid death data can lag a year behind.
Dr. Kara Crist directs the Arizona Department of Health Services. She's circling a crowded room with data specialists and others, poring over maps and charts.
What we're trying to do is reframe this from an addiction stigma, they're dead, we can move on, to a, this is a health condition and it needs to be dealt with just like every other public health issue.
Unlike an infectious disease outbreak, the state's healthcare system is not well equipped to track opioid deaths in real time. In fact, getting reliable statistics is difficult. A recent University of Virginia study found Arizona has been significantly underreporting the increase in overdose deaths. The declaration requires most providers to now report overdoses immediately to the state. Since mid-June, 200 people have reportedly died. Once they get enough data, Chris says the department can fashion a more comprehensive response. But she admits this public health crisis is different from others.
Things that you rapidly respond to, you can control, and then it comes to an end. The opioid epidemic is something that we've been dealing with for a long time.
Just ask her predecessor, Will Humble. It was during his early days as director. Humble was on the elevator chatting with the guy who ran statistics when he mentioned,
we were surprised to see that more people in Arizona died from opiate overdoses than from car crashes. I mean, this is back in 2010.
Humble, who now leads the Arizona Public Health Association, says that's when it hit him. He had the agency put together prescribing guidelines for physicians, but most people weren't paying attention.
You know, it was like we were shouting into the wind. It just didn't capture the attention of policymakers and elected officials.
That's finally changing, but there's still no dedicated state funding for the crisis, although Arizona does have several federal grants. But Humble says that's not necessarily the point of this declaration. Instead, it's
focusing those areas in state government that have leverage to mobilize their policy, not necessarily funding, but change their policy around opiate prescribing.
He says one example is the governor's directive to Arizona's Medicaid program, limiting the first prescription to 7 days. And Humble expects other efforts to come later and may require new laws and more money. But at least the declaration creates a sense of urgency.
I'd even go one step further, and I'd say that that might be the major benefit.
Dr. Michael Barnett is a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Massachusetts was the first state to declare a public health emergency because of the epidemic. Since then, others have followed. Mostly, this has meant increasing access to the opioid reversal drug naloxone. And Barnett says that's a start.
There's a much more limited capacity for extreme government intervention to necessarily make a difference here.
But it does also chip away at one of the most intractable problems, stigma, as Steve, who's now in recovery, remembers.
I always thought addicts are just terrible people who make terrible decisions, who just aren't strong enough. It's different. It's totally different.
And so is his life now. He's got a car and a job. But as overdoses skyrocket, his story may still be a rare one. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now, let's look at some developments in education this week. A group opposed to the expansion of Arizona's new Empowerment Scholarship Account expansion law submitted more than 111,000 petition signatures to state officials this week. From KJZZ's Education Desk, Carrie Young reports the move puts the law on hold for now.
A grassroots group known as Save Our Schools Arizona delivered the signatures to the Secretary of State's office on a school bus late Tuesday afternoon, carting dozens of boxes inside with little red wagons. State officials will now begin verifying if the required 75,000-plus signatures were collected. If the group makes the mark, the law would be blocked until November of 2018, when the question of whether to expand Arizona's private school voucher program would go before voters. Beth Lewis is Save Our Schools chair. She says while the group isn't opposed to Arizona's original voucher program, which restricted enrollment to certain groups of students like those with disabilities, she says the expansion diverts more money away from a public school system that she believes is woefully underfunded.
I, as a teacher, have filled out that paperwork myself, and I fully support it for those parents. But that's different than taking regular students out of A and B rated classrooms and putting them into private school that their parents can already afford.
Several dozen parents and kids were at the state capitol to oppose the referendum filing. Jennifer Bejarano says her husband had to work two jobs before the ESA expansion to cover tuition.
This was going to benefit me because he was going to quit his second job to be with us a little bit more.
While the state wouldn't have begun doling out the new funding until about October, some private schools have told parents they could enroll their kids and wait to pay tuition. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A group of Texas businesses and trade organizations are launching a coalition with their Mexican counterparts. They want to make sure the renegotiations of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, will benefit them, and they hope states like Arizona will follow their lead. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. will start to debate their free trade agreement next week. A Texan coalition supported by the Mexican government is already lobbying to protect its interests. Like Arizona, Mexico is Texas's number one business partner. Almost 40% of Texas' annual exports go to Mexico. Jeff Mosley is leader of the Texas-Mexico Trade Coalition. He says the alliance's main goal is to guarantee NAFTA will continue serving both nations.
Trade is between people, and governments provide the ability to do that fairly. So we want to make sure the document is fair and that it's working better.
Mosley says he already spoke to Arizona's business leaders to help them launch their own coalition. In a press conference Thursday, the Mexican Undersecretary for North American Affairs, Carlos Sada, confirmed Mexico is already building similar alliances with other American states. Sada says coalitions will help Mexican and American businesses prosper on both sides of the border. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
And finally, in business news, Arizona's minimum wage increased recently to $10 an hour. But even with higher pay, school districts are having a hard time filling some critical positions, teaching assistants and bus drivers, for instance. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Mariana Dale reports competition for those employees is coming from outside the classroom.
This is Paradise Valley Unified School District's first support staff job fair, and people are interested. There are already 40 job seekers in the first 20 minutes. Jennifer Olson has her eye on a part-time position that would align with her studies in special education psychology.
I don't want to give up being a mom to being able to work.
Michelle Otstadt is PV's Human Resources Director. She says the district hopes to fill 150 jobs before the school year starts. That includes coaches, crossing guards, and bus drivers.
It's a much smoother school year if we start with all of our positions full and the children have all the support that they need.
Paradise Valley's biggest demands are in special education classrooms, which could be good news for people like Olson. Linda Taylor directs special education at the district. She says the classroom assistants are the conduit between teachers and students.
They form the closest relationship because they are with them all day long.
But the position comes with some unique challenges.
It's also a tough job. Some of our positions require you to chase after a kid if we've got kids who are runners, sometimes students who are a little physically aggressive.
Taylor acknowledges that the pay, which starts at $10.86 an hour, isn't great, especially with the potential challenges on the job, which could be one reason why the department has so many open positions each year. Mesa Public Schools Assistant Superintendent Sean Holmes says the recent minimum wage hike has made competition even tougher. People who may have worked in schools might seek positions in the private sector, where the pay is also higher.
That has put pressure on our system, and I believe many systems around the state, to compete.
The higher starting salary also crunches the pay scale. For example, in Mesa, bus drivers used to make $4 more an hour than minimum wage. Now it's closer to $2. Lumbering yellow school buses get a checkup before the school year starts here at the Tempe Elementary School District. Jessica Palmer knows the fleet well. She started as a bus driver in 2005.
Well, actually, that bus right there, 33, was the bus I started on.
Now Palmer is the director of transportation. She says the district needs at least 10 people in the department this year, which is pretty typical.
You're having to deal with the ins and outs of traffic every day, and then you have to also maintain 60 students who are sitting behind you.
Palmer says those students are also the best part of the job.
A school bus driver is the first face a child sees and the last face a child sees on a regular school day. So you kind of set the tone for a student every day.
The money schools spend on bus drivers and many other so-called classified jobs is not considered classroom dollars. But the State School Board Association's Annabelle Aportella says those positions do have a direct impact on student learning.
I think there is in the narrative an impression that if it's not being spent in the classroom,
meaning teachers, that it's somehow being misspent.
While the Auditor General's report shows classroom spending is on a downward slope, ASBA points to increases in dollars for student support.
Nurses, guidance counselors, special education is a huge part of student support services, and those are mandated services.
Arizona schools do spend more on transportation, student support, and food service, but the state's overall spending is 30% lower than the national average. Arizona districts say without new funding, keeping positions staffed from the classroom to the playground is even more difficult. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Tempe.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Furtke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.